This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio. Lewis Lapham and Harper's Magazine are forever linked. As its editor for nearly 30 years, Lapham began each issue with Notebook, an essay written in his beautifully precise prose on the political and cultural climate of our times. He's been compared to Twain and to Montaigne. His expensive-looking suits, complete with pocket square, evoke another comparison. To sit with Lapham, you're struck with the sensation that you've stumbled onto some film noir set, and some of the stories he recounts belong to that genre, like when he got his first job as a rookie reporter at the San Francisco Examiner.
This is 1957. Reporters would lie around on couches with hats over their faces waiting for news of a murder. And then I, as the cub, would go out to the scene of the murder with the photographer. The photographer had a Speed Graflex camera, wore a shark skin suit and a loud hand-painted tie, and his name was Seymour Snare. Seymour and I would prowl the lower depths in order to find sensational headlines for the first edition. In those days, the paper had six or seven editions, and we would do the late afternoon edition with the murder headline.
And the, How old were you?
I was 22.
So you were a kid?
Entirely a kid.
And, this was not the background you came from. You didn't come from a tough working class background.
No. And that's one of the
Describe where you came from.
Well, I came out of the the affluent, privileged
San Francisco society.
San Francisco society. My grandfather was the mayor of the city between 1942 and 1946 during World War II. And he would go out on the launch to meet carriers when they would come in from the Pacific War. And I would be piped aboard with the mayor to meet Admiral Nimitz or Admiral Halsey on the bridge of the Enterprise. And also, he, as the mayor, presided over the Charter of the United Nations in 1945 in San Francisco, and he made sure that I was excused from school to attend the plenary sessions. And then he would give diplomatic cocktail parties, and I can remember at the age of 10 passing canapes to Molotov and to Stettinius and to Alger Hiss and John Foster Dulles. And then I went to boarding school in New England, and from there to Yale University, and after that to Cambridge, England.
At Cambridge, Lapham considered becoming a history professor, but decided he wasn't cut out for the footnotes. Then he briefly toyed with acting, but realized he was only good at playing characters to whom he was sympathetic. In the end, journalism called. Lewis Lapham says he was a precious youth when he got back from England and took the job at the San Francisco Examiner. He had a lot to learn.
I can remember, Alec, the first piece I ever wrote for the paper was in Oakland. They sent me to cover a flower show, and I went to the flower show, and I wrote 4,000 words. And with all kinds of wonderful adjectives that straight out of Henry James, right? And the senior guy on the beat in Oakland was a man named Crowley. And he looked at me and he said, "Lewis, these are the most beautiful 4,000 words I have ever read." He said, there were tears in my eyes. But he said, "I tell you what, why don't you see if you can cut it in half?" Great pain.
Sure.
I was, destroying
your child.
Immortal. I brought it back to Crowley, and Crowley looked at him and said, "Lewis, I thought the first 4,000 words were truly beautiful, but these are even more beautiful. But see if you can cut it in half again." And we went through this over a period of – it finally came out as one paragraph.
Oh, God.
And what I learned in the newspaper business was to write – on deadline, but also to trim and
concision.
Concision, yeah.
And then when you left
and the other reason, of course, to be in the newspaper business was to learn about the you know, the American democracy. I mean, I didn't know how a city worked or what politics were or, you know, I'd lived a privileged life in a bubble.
What were some of the first insights you had into the American political system from that vantage point?
It was really about who you knew. I mean, it wasn't the...
Right or wrong.
It was what was the deal? What was the trade? Could we both get something out of this? It mattered that you could speak well, that you were adroit, also that you liked people. My sense of most of the politicians I've known have been that they have genuine liking for their fellow human beings. I mean, there are exceptions.
Such as?
Cheney would be a beautiful example. Right. I mean, Cheney, I think, and the trouble with so many of the conservative politicians that have been in power over the last 30 years is they don't have that quality, or at least they don't seem to me to have that quality. You see, this is the difference between a democratic society is one and it is held together by mutual feeling and respect for one's fellow citizen. I hold my fellow citizen in thoughtful regard, not because he is beautiful or rich or famous, but because he is my fellow citizen. The kind of a society that gathers around a court, the kind of society that you would see in the court of either Elizabeth I or Louis XIV, a court society is one where it is all about interest. It is all about hanging in the trapeze of one's connections and what it's very, very cold. I mean, that's the whole move toward the resort gated community. I mean, the rich, in the United States today, I mean, live in a completely different world.
But do you think it's always been that way? Meaning, are the wealthy today different from the wealthy two generations ago, three generations ago?
I think they probably are. I mean, there's always a distinction between. There's always a class distinction. I mean, you can. There's no society in the history of mankind that hasn't been organized along some form of class distinction. I mean, we organize it in terms of money. We were doing that pretty much from the beginning. I mean, the settlement at Plymouth in 1620 is a venture capital deal. It is. I mean, it's backed by merchant bankers in London.
Well, first of all, when you talk about people aligning themselves from the beginning on the basis of class.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how you've experienced that in your family. What was your father's politics to the extent you want to say? And did you differ from your family? Were your politics, because your politics are pretty, I wouldn't use the word liberal or progressive, but they're candor is the watchword here, I think.
Yeah. No.
Were they disappointed in the way you?
No.
Was your father a pretty open-minded guy?
Yes. My father had been very strongly in favor of Roosevelt in 1932. And his father, my grandfather, the one who became the mayor, was strongly conservative Republican who thought that FDR was the end of the world.
Sure. Wouldn't carry a dime in his pocket.
Right. No. On the other hand, by the time grandfather got to be mayor of San Francisco in 1942, he ran as an independent, and he was very open. I mean, he would pick hitchhikers up. He never had a bodyguard. He never had tinted windows.
He
used to like to go into the, saloons in San Francisco late at night, and he wanted to get a bond issue passed to replace the streetcars on Market Street with buses. And there was some resistance about that. So he put it to a bet. He said, okay, there'll be a race. I will race from the ferry building to City Hall, I will ride an elephant against a trolley car. And if the elephant beats the trolley car, we have the bond issue. If not, not. But he was a gambling man, so he insisted on a handicap, and the handicap was that the elephant would be allowed to go through red lights. The elephant won. The bond issue passed.
Now, when you leave San Francisco 3 years doing the newspaper, where do you go from there?
I go to New York. I go from the San Francisco Examiner. I come to New York, the Herald Tribune.
How long were you there?
I was there 2 years.
What did you write about for them?
First of all, I was general assignment. Cover the city, the mayor, crime.
Who was the mayor?
Wagner, I think. Yeah,
Robert.
Yeah. And then I was sent to the UN. I became the third correspondent over there. I was at the UN when Khrushchev was there, pounding his shoe on the table, and when Castro was there, carrying the chickens to Harlem. I was then sent down to write about the Cape Canaveral, the first subspace shot. So, you know, I did a lot of different things.
Right. So after the Herald Tribune, what did you do?
There was a new magazine called USA One, and I became staff writer for the new magazine. It folded after 6 months. I then became a staff writer for the Saturday Evening Post, which was a big deal in 1963.
Yeah, they were still going strong.
They were still going strong. I mean, in 1960, Life and the Saturday Evening Post were the equivalent of what the networks became by the end of the 60s.
Right.
If the president wanted to talk to the American people, he would either sit down with Joseph or Stuart Alsop for the back page interview in the Post or with Teddy White in the back page interview Life. That was mass media.
Back in the time, people also, I remember my grandfather in the early 60s, and he lived in Brooklyn. He would read 5 newspapers a day. There was a morning paper. There was an evening paper.
Oh, yeah.
You know, New York was swimming in newspapers then.
There were 11 newspapers in New York in 1960 when I came, including the Brooklyn Eagle, which was...
That was the paper he read that.
The best newspaper in some people's opinion, in all the 5 boroughs.
Right.
So I traveled all over the world for the Saturday Evening Post. I mean, I did stories in California, went and spent 2 weeks with the Beatles and the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in Rishikesh.
What was that experience like? Can you encapsulate that? What was it like hanging out with them in India?
Well,
did you get any time with them?
No, not really. I got a little time with them. There was something called transcendental meditation, which was all the rage in 1967. And the Maharishi was giving people mantras whispering them in their ears. And the Beatles had gone there for a retreat.
They needed to chill out.
They needed to chill out.
Being a Beatle was stressful.
Stressful. I mean,
the pressure. Signing all those love letters. Singing those songs. McCartney told me once that they would record 4 songs a day. They wanted to keep the studio time down to a minimum. It was expensive. So they'd record 2 songs in the morning, then they go have some fish and chips, smoke a cigarette, come back and do 2 songs in the afternoon.
Well,
it was a real grind, he said, being a Beatle in the early days.
But by 1967, they're the biggest thing in the world.
Now they're taking a little more time.
I was sent to become to somehow get into the ashram. No press, of course, was allowed.
So how would you do that? When someone you're working for says, go get into the ashram, how do you do that?
Politics.
It's deal making.
First of all, I went to California to talk to devotees of the Maharishi.
So you did a little briefing.
So that when I got to Rishikesh, and I got in the cab and I said to the driver,
to the ashram.
I said, to Rishikesh. And he says, you go Beatles. I said, I go Beatles. And it was $12, 112 miles.
Those were the days.
Those were the days. And then I found out that one of the Maharishi's main men, Raghavendra, a major domo, would come down once or twice a day to the town to shop. And I struck with an acquaintance with Raghavendra, impressed Raghavendra as to my knowledge of
you dropped a few clever phrases here.
I understand. He understood
bon mot of the transcendental world.
Exactly. wormed my way into the confidence of Ragven, and then explained to him that I was from the Saturday Evening Post, biggest media in America, and the Maharishi was a publicity hound. Okay. But believe me, it was in no way critical. I was here to gaze into the mysteries of the East and to
at the same time make the Maharishi the Martha Stewart
exactly,
of transcendental.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're gonna blow it open for him.
And eventually Raghavendra admitted me to the ashram. I was allowed through the gate.
Yes.
There must have been 70 meditators present, as well as the Beatles. I mean, because he ran this ashram.
So the Beatles didn't have a private. They were in a group.
They had a bungalow to themselves.
Yeah.
And they also had provisions that were sent in from London, because the food that was being served at the common table
was wanting.
Yes. Very, very bland.
Yeah. Some unseasoned dal.
Yes. But, you know, I attended some of the open sessions. I would have an occasional aside with one of the Beatles. I mean, McCartney, I thought, had a wonderful sense of humor, and so did Ringo. I never really got far enough into abstraction to understand Lennon, but there were a lot of other people to write about. I mean, I had a conversation with Mia Farrow. She showed up. The most beautiful model in the world at that time was a girl named Marissa Berenson.
Sure.
And she showed up with her French boyfriend who had a mink coat. And then the Beach Boys showed up and Donovan showed up. There was the wife of an Air Force colonel from California who'd been living in Beverly Hills. But her husband had left her one night because a UFO had landed on the lawn of their house in Beverly Hills, and he had gone with them. There were a lot of characters.
And up until then, it's you and Mr. Snare taking pictures in Oakland, and then you come and do the general assignment, and you're covering Wagner et al. In New York for the Trib.
Yeah, yeah.
But would you say there was a time in your writing, was there a moment, and can you track it? Was there something happening in the country? Because I'll give you in a prefatory way, like a story about my dad. My dad turned 40 in 1967. And when he turned 40, he was a school teacher making no money, had six children. Back in the day when people had six children on faith, you know, there was this believed in Providence,
right.
These Irish Catholics. And in the ensuing 12 months from the fall of 1967, my father, who was a staunch Democrat, he was a Democratic committeeman and a very progressive Democrat when I was young, in the ensuing 12 months, King is shot. Kennedy is shot. My father's political nemesis is resurrected from the dead. The Democratic Convention is a debacle in Chicago. Nixon becomes president, and his mother dies that October. So in that 12 months, like everything my father held dear just seemed to come crashing down. And I will say that my father was never the same again. Was there some series of events, was a period you went through when everything started to get a lot more real to you politically? A period in our history, perhaps.
Well, there were several. I mean, I said earlier when I was talking about the Maharishi, it was 67. It wasn't. It was 68. And that is it's the same month as Tet. And that's the same year as Kennedy and
King
and
Chicago.
And Chicago.
And Nixon.
And Nixon. On the other hand, I was kind of prepared for that because when I was in Cambridge, England, and here I'm still 22 years old and young, and at Yale, I have not been I wasn't a white shoe type guy. I went to one football game my freshman year, and then I spent the rest of the weekends in New York because that was wonderful in New York in the 50s. I mean, I had access to an apartment that Auden would sometimes hold forth in down in the Village. And my idea of an evening would be to go to listen to Auden hold forth and then go up to Birdland and listen to Parker play and or Mingus, or go over to the Whitehorse Tavern and watch Dylan Thomas drink himself to death. I mean, I was extreme. I mean, I was in love with the poetry.
Time.
I knew I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know what kind of a writer. But then I go to England. The fall of 1956 is the uprising in Hungary and the Suez Crisis. And a couple of the young Englishmen that I had become friends with went to Hungary to take part in the protest against the Soviets. And one of them was killed. If you remember the history, we had promised, the CIA had promised to back the Hungarian Revolution, which, of course, we did not. Then I suddenly was asked to explain the Suez policy of John Foster Dulles, which I couldn't do because I hadn't been reading as an undergraduate newspapers. I'd been reading Auden or Brecht or literature. And I decided when I first came back to America in the summer of 1957, I went to Washington to apply for jobs. I applied to the Washington Post, the White House, to see if I could get some sort of clerk's job in the basement. And I went to apply for the CIA.
What did you imagine you were going to have to offer the CIA? What were you going to do?
I was going to...
write?
It was totally romantic. It was trench coat, last train to Berlin, blonde.
Fighting communism.
Fighting communism. I passed the mental test, and I passed the physical and psychological test, and then I had the interview with some. What they said, some of the younger guys. I'm 22. These guys must have been somewhere between 27, 30, I mean, like that. All Yale. Looked like, sounded like George W. Bush.
W. So this, you're saying there's what kind of a demeanor to them? Frat boy demeanor?
Yeah. These are the kind of guys that I had avoided during my entire 4 years at
Yale. You weren't at the ball game. You were reading Ionesco.
I'm in New York, right? But I've studied for this. I haven't quite written things on my cuff. But I'm prepared. I mean, I know the four roads into the Argonne Forest. I am prepared to talk about the Romanov dynasty. I know about Stalin's crimes. And, you know, first question, Alec, I'm not making this up. You were standing on the 13th tee of the National Golf Links in Southampton. What club do you hit? I got that one right. I'd done that. I knew the answer to that question. Second question, 6 p.m. last week in August, you were coming in on the final approach to the Yacht Club at Hay Harbor and Fisher's Island. What tack are you on? I knew that, too, because I'd done that, too.
So you're doing well.
2 for 3. Third, does Minxie, I can't remember Minxie's last name, wear a slip? Minxie was the great nymphomaniac of the Ivy League circuit in the 50s, and not to have known Minxie was not to have lived, and right.
not to have known her wardrobe.
Yes. And I said to them, gentlemen, my information is secondhand. I've had rumors, French silk, Belgian lace.
But, I hear tell.
But I sources are untrustworthy, and we're usually drunk. And then I said, and besides that, I apologize for wasting your time. And I got up and walked out. I thought, my God, I mean, if this is
the fence I've got to jump.
I've never been surprised since
right.
about the blunders of the CIA. I mean, the arrogance, the idea that they...
Yeah, we'll figure out your knowledge of Yugoslavian history later on or of that region. Are you one of us?
Yeah. Are you fit for the fraternity? Are you the right sort?
Are you one of us?
That was it.
Thus, Lewis Lapham tossed aside another career possibility. This is Alec Baldwin. You're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio. More in a minute. This is Alec Baldwin. You're listening to Here's the Thing. My guest Lewis Lapham's job at the Saturday Evening Post abruptly ended when the magazine folded in 1969. He was quickly hired at Life magazine, which also went bust. In 1970, Lapham joined Harper's Magazine, where, except for some intervening years, he stayed until 2006. Lapham started at Harper's as a contract writer and soon became an editor. He has mentioned that he, quote, edited the magazine with a sympathy for the writer rather than the editor, end quote.
And as you know, Alec, I mean, you know, good writing, good essay writing, good any kind of writing is an adventure. I mean, you really don't know where you're going to end up. It's not a programmatic. It's not like writing an annual report or writing a, a baseball score. So over the course of time, I taught myself to write essays.
And when did you take over the show over there?
I took over the show in 1975.
And you created the Harper's Index, correct?
Yeah, but I do that later. I'm now the editor of 75, and then I get fired in 1981 because by this time it's changed hands. It's now in the hands of the MacArthur Foundation from Chicago. And the first time I was introduced to the board, I knew that it was
curtains.
Over. It's not a question of whether I was going to be fired next week or next month, but it was 6 months later because they didn't like what I wrote. I mean, I was writing essays that were sometimes critical of American policy, politics, culture.
You said 81.
Yeah, 81.
They give you the heave-ho. And then what happens?
Then I spent 2 years in exile. And then young John MacArthur, heir to the MacArthur Foundation fortune, became a member of the board, and I was reinstated. I said, Rick, I'll be happy to go back, but only if, A, I can fire all the members of the board that fired me, and two, that I can completely redesign the magazine.
And when do you invent the index?
Right, so when I come back. I mean, I redesign
the whole thing. Where did you get that idea? And when you say redesign, it was in order to do what? Just the layout?
Well, yeah, I brought the readings to it. The index.
Reading, yeah. Now, when you started your own magazine, when you started
Lapham's Quarterly, yeah.
Whose idea was that?
Mine. I mean, it was something I'd wanted to do for a long time. I mean, it goes back to my interest in history. The Quarterly.
There's a lot of history in the Quarterly.
What it is the great books made topical. I mean, I take a subject in the news, war, money, politics, right, nature, medicine, and then assemble texts. My contributors are people like Aeschylus, Cicero, Gibbon, Machiavelli, Shakespeare. It's based on my notion that it's actually the notion of the German poet Goethe is talking about history, and he says history is it's our inheritance. The story on the old walls or printed in the old books is also our own story. And Goethe says, he who cannot draw on 3,000 years is living hand to mouth. And that's true.
You find history exhilarating.
I do. I find it
essential.
Essential. I find it a great source of energy and hope. I mean,
you have a quote here in which you say the reading of history damps down the impulse to slander, the trend and tenor of the times, instills a sense of humor, lessens our fear about what might happen tomorrow.
That's true. When you understand the obstacles that people have had to overcome, nothing that improves man's condition or circumstance is accomplished without going up against very heavy odds. This is what history teaches you, so that you don't despair of your own time. You don't say, God, America is in decline.
If you look at history, then America's always been in decline.
Yeah.
If you look at history, a golden age was really just the time when they got away with it.
That's right. History is not what happened 200 or 2,000 years ago. It's a story about what happened 200 or 2,000 years ago.
People wrote about what happened to them.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you have how many children?
Three.
And are any of them involved in publishing at all?
No.
No. Are they deeply political people? Are they have strong political opinions? Do they share yours, for that matter?
My older son does, to some degree. My older
what
son.
What does he do for a living, if I may ask?
He's in the financial business, in private equity, in Toronto, in Canada.
Right. How did he end up there?
He ended up up there because he married a Canadian girl. Okay. And also, Toronto's a pretty good place to live. I mean, he has four children. He could provide for them a better life there than he could, say, in New York City.
And what about your other two children?
My daughter is married to an Italian prince and lives outside Rome. And my younger son is also in the financial business, and he is working in a small venture capital firm in Monaco.
Did you ever think you'd have kids and you'd be able to say that? You have three kids, and all three of them live overseas, and we're out of the country.
All three of them
live overseas. One in Canada, one in Rome, one in Monaco.
Right. Yeah. And my six grandchildren are all overseas, too. Four of them.
Do you travel there all the time?
I travel, not all the time, but I travel.
Enough to keep it warm.
Yeah, and they come here.
Now, you've obviously are very keen on history, and embedded in much, if not all, of your writing. And for people who don't know you, you're a very handsome, very elegant, the pocket square, the crisp suit, the tie. You're a very handsome devil, you know, and I'm sure that every door has been opened to you for you over the years. You're great. You're the person everyone wants to sit next to at a dinner. Yeah. And my question becomes, I'm going to name five figures from history. And I'll keep naming some until we get it right, because maybe the answer is you never met them and you had no opinion of them. But I'll name some over the course of American history, and you tell me what your assessment of them was, to the extent you're willing to.
Yeah.
Either John or Robert Kennedy, did you meet either one of them?
I met them both.
What were the circumstances of meeting John?
It was a party. It's actually, I met them both at the same time. It was a party given for Teddy Kennedy. And it was a birthday party for Teddy, and it's either 62 or 63.
Southampton?
No, New York, Fifth Avenue. They had a big apartment on Fifth Avenue.
Right.
I was, at the time, going out with a young lady who was also going out with Bobby.
Right.
I was a beard at the day. You're familiar with that term.
Yes.
At the dinner.
You were a contract beard.
Yeah.
This is 62.
I think this is 62.
You're 27 years old.
Yeah, it's either 62 or 63.
What'd you make of either one of them?
What
do you make of them in retrospect in history, through the prism of history? What do you think about either one of them?
I'm learning to like them more now than I did then. Let's go back. I'm the UN correspondent for the Herald Tribune. When Kennedy is inaugurated, the speech asks not what America can do for you, but what you can do for America. I'm watching it with the correspondents from foreign correspondents. And the guy from Le Monde listens to that speech and says, that's the worst naive
treacle,
right? And I almost got in a fight with him, right? I was very gung-ho, Kennedy. I think seeing him in the setup at the
UN
at Smith's apartment was a real disappointment. He seemed like he was a guy who was hounded by demons, and I also knew something about his relations with women at the time.
Didn't think he had his house in order enough to be
president?
No, I didn't
think so.
Yeah. And what about his brother? Did you get the same feeling?
His brother, I thought, was a bully.
Right. Because many, many people have a very negative assessment of him up until his brother's killed.
Yeah.
Did you meet Nixon?
Yes, I met Nixon once, and I'm trying to remember. I never liked or trusted Nixon, and I can't remember where I met him. I met him someplace in California, but at a distance. I mean, I was never—I was part of a crowd or something.
Isn't it interesting how people that I know who are not as astute as you are about history, but they're students of history. They're certainly students of American history.
Yeah.
They certainly know the political history of this country.
Yeah.
And many of my friends who are politically active, and I mean beyond— writing checks and that kind of political class where it's all about giving money, and in that world, I've heard people say, "God, I take Nixon back tomorrow compared to these guys that are here." I mean, there was a lot of good with Nixon. Do you agree with that?
I don't know enough to agree or disagree with it. I know that he backed the Environmental Protection Agency.
Right.
I know that he backed the what's the Employment Act that, that if you get hurt?
Workman's compensation. But there was a lot of good under Nixon.
Yeah.
What did you think of Romney? And more importantly, inside the question of what you think of Romney, what do you think about, shall we say, the casting department of the Republican Party? They seem to, because Obama was theirs for the taking, don't you think?
I think Obama could have been defeated. Yeah, I think he was lucky to win, just the way I think he was lucky to win, in 2008 when the Republicans put up Sarah Palin. But yes, I thought it was a pretty clownish group of primary candidates that were fielded by the the Republicans. My sense of Romney, I saw him in a small room once, but trying to drum up money from some Wall Street guys in New York, he didn't come off any differently than you've seen him on television.
It was almost impossible for Romney to overcome what Gingrich said about him during the primary.
Yeah.
What do you think about Obama?
I think Obama means well.
You think that's enough these days?
Probably not. Again, how much can a president really accomplish is another problem. I mean, I don't think he's the... He likes politics in the same way that, say, Johnson did.
Right.
Johnson really wanted to use the office of the presidency to do something and knew how to make it work, knew that it was political. I'm never sure that Obama is about anything other than a striking of poses, nor am I sure that that is not what the office of the presidency has become. Why anybody would want to become president of the United States is something that I have I can't imagine wanting to do that, because when you think about what is that life like, I mean, you're surrounded by people that are probably lying to you. I mean, it's like a life at court in Queen Elizabeth's England or Louis XIV's France. It's cold-hearted self-interest. It's not... require a degree of vanity I can imagine it, but it's
yeah.
it's
well, we've heard that comment before, where people have said the type of man or woman that would want to be president now is someone we certainly don't want to be president.
Yeah,
now.
Probably not. Lincoln wanted to be president. He wouldn't have wanted to run for – I mean, his running for a second term, I mean, he was reluctant. I mean, you know, there are people that are happy to leave the office. To leave the stage.
As my friend said about one political figure, he just doesn't know when to leave the stage.
It's a thankless task, yeah. Alec. Really, it is. I mean,
it's service. It's service. It's service to your country.
Yeah.
Lewis Lapham continues to serve his country. At 77, he still goes to work every day at Lapham's Quarterly. After our conversation, I wondered why Lapham hadn't cultivated more personal relationships with the political leaders of his day. So...
Hello?
It's Alec Baldwin calling for Mr. Lapham.
Mr. Lapham is speaking.
You know, Lewis, when you were here and we talked about, something, a number of things, but one thing that kind of stuck in my mind was that you had this access to all of these political figures, government leaders of their time and so forth, and you were around them and reporting about them. And yet it sounds to me like you didn't make them intimates of yours.
No, I did not.
And I was wondering, why was that the case?
Well, because I thought of myself as a journalist, and I wanted to be free to say what I thought or report what I thought I'd seen, and I didn't want to become obligated. I wanted to keep a safe distance.
You know, I appreciate that, because, I mean, that's a very common thing that people, when the... political leaders started to, you know, hang out and party with the press,
yeah.
when they invited them in the door to stay,
yeah.
everything began to change.
Yeah, everything does begin to change, and that's what begins to happen, of course, in the 60s, when politics becomes glamorous, and Kennedy and Camelot and the heady association with power, it's...
You would ascribe that phenomenon kind of beginning with Kennedy?
Well, that was when I first became aware of it. I mean, I'm sure it was true at the court of Louis XIV and Elizabeth I. It's true of any court society. I once wrote a essay about the American media. The title was Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, mm-hmm. and that's the way I tend to think of the Washington Press Corps. Mm-hmm.
The struggle for me is that if you, and I don't mean to sound lofty here, but you have kind of a Clinton war room, Carville-esque approach toward dealing with the media, which is that you put out every fire and you address every issue where your name is dragged in.
Yeah.
Or you try to remain above the fray and ignore it, knowing that we'll all, I mean, unless there's real criminal charges at stake, you know that it will dissipate. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for me. In other words, do you think I'm better off, where there's nothing serious involved, do you think I'm better off not engaging and letting it go and it just wafts away like smoke? Or do you think that journalism today and the media establishment today is a bull I need to be fighting from time to time?
I don't think you need to fight it, Alec, because you'll always lose. Can I tell you my introduction to that?
Yes.
My first lesson in this was in the Oakland City Hall press room. I mentioned Seymour Snare, but the press room is in the same building as the police department and the courts and the mayor's office. The head of the vice squad was anxious to become a particular friend of the media and of the press, and so that the press would play him as an heroic figure, which the press obligingly did. The vice squad guy also had a girlfriend who was a serious nymphomaniac. He used to make her available to the members of the press room on, you know, the third Friday of every month.
Hmm.
She was very good looking, but she had only one leg.
She was a beautiful, one-legged nymphomaniac who was the paramour of the head of the vice squad.
Exactly. And I, being the cub, I was not invited to the Friday afternoon celebrations, nor did I want to be. But the day then comes when she was married and the lady's husband files divorce suit and names the vice squad captain as the correspondent. I was in the press room the day that that announcement was made, and suddenly these four guys, you know, rise reluctantly to their typewriters and begin to write morally outraged editorials. How can such things be? How can our fair city of Oakland tolerate the behavior of a corrupt police captain? I mean, you see what I mean? I mean,
yes.
They turned on a dime. What I'm telling you is the media is not trustworthy.
Yeah. It's Claude Rains closing down the casino.
Yeah.
I'm outraged.
Yeah.
I'm outraged. And the guy was,
yes, that's right.
You're shocked. Winning, sir. I'm shocked. Shocked that there's gambling here. You're winning, sir.
Right. Yeah. It's not good to get involved, I don't think, in an argument with the media because they always have the last word.
You want to know something? You've just done me a big favor. Your pen is mighty. Your mind and your words are mighty. And with a single phone call here, you have crushed my entire public relations apparatus into powder. But I'm grateful to you for it.
Thanks.
This is Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing comes from WNYC Radio.